Hello, it's on this day, happy Tuesday, it is the 21st of April. I'm going to look back in Liverpool's history at two games that happened on this day in Liverpool's past, and we've also got a birthday shout right at the end as well, and an interesting chat about a Liverpool career that never really got going. But to join me to do all that, I've got Neil Atkinson and Kevin Walsh, and we're going to start in 2019 on my notes there, it absolutely wasn't. 2009, Liverpool 4, Arsenal 4. Just a bit of context for this game. It was in the Premier League, but Liverpool had gone out of the Champions League the week before, leaving the Premier League as their only possible trophy. They go into the game 1 point behind leaders Man United, but having already played a game more. And there's a sort of general feeling that we need to be perfect until the end of the season. Arsenal are fourth, but very little to play for in the league, with a comfortable buffer to Villa in fifth. And it was funny looking at the table, Kev, because first of all, before we even get onto the game, to remember when it was very much a top four, and it was a huge jump after that, and then after that it grew to, you know, Man City, and then Spurs, and now it's, you know, it's talked over the top six. But you know, you look at sort of who's behind that, so it's Villa who were sort of fifth, and I don't think anyone's suggesting Villa were about to break into the top four anytime soon.
No, but Villa around that time, they had quite a number of seasons, quite a bit like Everton, I suppose, where Everton go on a decent run. There's a few years where they were sort of fifth, sixth, seventh, and sort of looking to push on. But like most teams that ends up getting into that position, they do probably two seasons or three seasons and then fall away. But nowadays, as you say, top six, and you're probably going to see that push into top seven and top eight when you get the likes of Leicester and Wolves kicking on.
Yeah, it's that time where these top four clubs, Neil, are there or thereabouts each season. You know, Leeds have done some early work in the early 2000s, but fallen away. Newcastle as well, you know, sort of threatened. But by this point, it's these four clubs are dominating and doing so well in Europe as well.
Yeah, I think it's also the fact that they play a lot of European football, and then they play one another in European football as well. I think this season, Manchester United and Chelsea is the Champions League final, or maybe that was the year before. Where we've just been beaten by Chelsea in the semi-final. You know, you come into the season before, we play Arsenal in the quarter-final of the Champions League. You know, you come into these games and you're left with so much knowledge and so much recent history, not the idea of ancient history, but recent history of battles between these sides. And I think it's testament to where those teams were at that stage. I think, you know, Villa of one of the reasons why we're still just a little bit behind Manchester United here is that Villa squandered a perfectly good lead at Old Trafford a couple of weeks before this. And if they hadn't have done, they may well have been a little closer. But it was the thing that was happened with the sides below would be, and it's one of the best things that Benitez addresses, and he addresses it early, but two things would happen. One would be dips of stamina in games themselves, and then a lot of sides would get relatively close to the top four and then fall away over the course of the season. And this really is the era where you can say it's a marathon, not a sprint, to be quite honest with you. And then the same thing starts to happen, as I think we've discussed as well. When you look at this era, there's a lot of Arsenal being really good, really strong, top two in February, and then they disappeared off a cliff come May. And I just think that there was a lot of, you know, the strength and depth of United and Chelsea is still, you know, I think is still almost underrated. The absolute, you know, Chelsea had like 43 international central midfielders at any given time, and they just dropped them in and out depending on what they needed and whose legs they needed to absolutely ruin next. And that's what you were up against if you were trying to win this league.
Yeah, certainly. Okay, yeah, we'll go on to the game in itself. And, you know, it finishes up 4-0. I forget, it's actually only 1-0 to Arsenal at half-time, but the second half, you know, it certainly makes up for it in terms of madness. And Liverpool actually goes 2-1 up. It's the only time they do lead in the entire game. The equaliser comes from a Torres header. Kevin, I've sort of forgotten how good he is in the air. You think, oh, he scores a few headers, but this one's a reminder because it's behind him. And it's sort of a bit of a floated cross as well from Kout, I think it is. But so he's got to get all the power and all the direction, and he manages it. He was some header of the ball.
Well, he was some everything of the ball, wasn't he? He was the absolute ultimate footballer. And he was like, if you could have designed a perfect striker, well, for any time really, but specifically that time where a lot of pace and power was necessary and maybe a lot of having to do work up front on your own, he was it. He could do it with his left foot and his right foot, but as you say, his head ability is often forgotten about. But he scored a number of goals like that. He scored one at Old Trafford, where he sort of he leaps so high, but then he twists his whole body and puts it across Edwin van der Sar one year as well. I think that, I can't remember what particular game was, but this one, as you say, he has to generate all the power itself. And it's not a close header either. He's probably 12 yards out, and it still goes past the goalkeeper before he's got a chance to move. But around this time, and in that kit and in that team, Fernando Torres was just, he was unplayable. And we were the envy of the world because we had him, because he was the first Liverpool sort of superstar we'd had since, I know Steven Gerrard was obviously brilliant, but I mean, like, a striker's always the one who you think, isn't it, oh my god, these are absolutely amazing. And he'd the first one we'd had since Fowler really had been at his pump, and the whole cop was in love with him. And when he played in games like this, you could see other teams were just thinking, what are we supposed to do to stop him here? Because he gets the header, doesn't he? He scores another goal where he gets the ball, turns, and he just seems to have a yard of space where there's no yard of space. And then before you know it, the ball's in the back of the net.
Yeah, Yossi Benyoun puts us in ahead, Neil. It's 7 minutes later. It's, you know, he puts his body on the line, to be fair to them. You don't necessarily associate that with Yossi, but I mean, he's doing bits of everything by this point of the season. But, you know, he nearly kills himself back post putting this one in.
Yeah, he very much does nearly kill himself. It's bananas, actually. The whole scenario around it. It's one of my, I mean, this for me, this is almost the defining game of the decade. And I've used the word almost there, and I probably don't need to. It is the game which, you know, everything's been leading to this in a really, really strange way. In that, it's the until Crystal Palace away, it is the best way possible you can lose a league title. And one of the things that's happened through this game and through the second half of the season is that basically Yossi Benayoun's been better than Messi. And he's absolutely come to the party in a way that is difficult to actually remember and describe now. He was exactly what we needed, simultaneously off a flank, because Riera stops getting games in the middle of the season, and we start this one. And then he comes and plays centrally behind Torres when Gerrard gets injured, because the other thing that's forgotten a little bit about 08-09 isn't just that we had a thin squad, but Gerrard doesn't play anywhere near as many games as you might think he does. And it's one of his goals to games ratio that season. Gerrard is off the charts good. And we finish the season, this game for instance, no Gerrard and Benayoun starts. And Benayoun has three or four months where he genuinely is the best player in the country. It's not an exaggeration. I'm not being funny. Every single time he steps onto the pitch, his appreciation of everything around him, his ability to go past people, his creative spark is just tremendous. And he adds goals. So there's the one at Fulham, and there's these two here. And the second goal of the game, his goal is just tremendous. In that it gets celebrated about 100 times because everyone's worried about him, and it's right in front of the cop, and he looks like he's completely poleaxed. And then as every player peels away from being worried about him, that player lets onto the cop, and the cop cheers again until there's only really Yossi gets up and he's all right, and everyone's absolutely going bananas. And I think it's actually one of the reasons why Liverpool don't kill the game. They go 2-1 up and they don't kill the game. And one of the reasons why is I think everyone's blood's absolutely pumping because the atmosphere was electric that night. It really was. It was absolutely electric, and it felt like magic was in the air. And so Liverpool don't try and sit on the lead at 2-1. They try to kill the game, and they're really, really aggressive against this Arsenal side all the way through the match. They're absolutely pumped up, and I think all of that with Yossi sort of factors into it.
Yeah, it's 44 appearances in all comps this season from Gerrard. Neil mentions that before, which is, yeah, it's low, isn't it? It's his lowest one since 04-05 when he dips to 43. Quite a few injuries sort of that year as well. But Arsenal come back into it. They go 3-2 up. And what strikes me watching these goals back, Kev, is everyone, we give it away. We give the ball away. It's not like it's not bad defending. You think of a 4-0, you think, oh, the defender must have been awful. We just keep giving them the ball.
We keep giving them it, but in the worst position. We give them it as we're attacking, but it seems like every one of our midfielders is trying to make a third man run into the box. We must have 16 men in their box. We lose the ball. It's just most of the goals come from just a big, not a punch, but a long pass through the centre of the midfield. And Arshavin's just there every fucking time, isn't he? He's absolutely on fire on the night. But against an Arsenal team, these were by no means a classic Arsenal team, but they were still very good. And if you're losing the ball in positions like that against them, you're going to pay for it. And as you say, the defenders must have been thinking, what are we supposed to do here? Because they weren't necessarily in defensive positions where they're having a battle with somebody. They're literally, they've got three and four men swarming all over them, and quick players as well for Arsenal. And so by the time Arsenal have got to the edge of our box, our defenders are chasing them rather than trying to front them up, and they've got no chance by them.
Yeah, I mean, there's more goals to come, Neil. There's the Torres equaliser. There's the mad fourth that Arsenal get when we're breaking everyone forward and Arshavin just gets to kind of run through the centre. And then there's Yossi having his say. I mean, it's a game that has everything. You know, it's got so much quality in it. It's got a lot of mistakes as well. As you say, the atmosphere was electric. You've written, you know, a couple of times beautifully sort of about this game, really. And you know, how it's... You know, it is the end of Liverpool's title challenge, really. Arsenal, you know, don't drop points again this season until there's a goalless draw, which is all they need against Arsenal to win it. Liverpool go on and win the last five from here, fair play to them, but it isn't quite enough. It does feel, even in the ground coming out, you did have the feeling of, look, they're throwing everything at that, but that probably is it for this season.
It's the last game managed by Rafa Benitez. Frankly, you know, I think, you know, he obviously goes on and manages others, but it's the last one that matters in the grand scheme of things. It's the last throw of the dice of that era. And looking back on it now, maybe we did sort of know that if you walked out to the ground, it was a night game, and it all felt very, very mysterious. It was a very strange thing to happen. You know, you don't get that many 4-alls, and Liverpool have actually had two back-to-back.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's something which... It did beg a belief, to be honest with you, but the flip side is that it did feel like the end of something. It really did. It felt like the end of that season, and I think we all thought, well, we'll dust ourselves down and go again, but what was happening behind the scenes meant that was impossible, and it was the end. The end's come, the end happens. It happens for different managers at different times. I'd argue for Rodgers, for instance, it was away at Arsenal when it looks like we're not going to be able to get Champions League football for the following season and everyone's pretty crushed. And then you go on and you play some more matches, but ultimately the last meaningful action was that. And for this Liverpool side, they go on and they win the games to end the season. They're great at Hull. You know, the day when they are great at Hull, United look like they're going to drop points to Tottenham, but they don't. And then from there, they do really, really well against, I think it's, they've got Newcastle, they've got West Ham in the post. Can't quite, they must have played someone else. There's Tottenham as well. But it doesn't matter. And you come out the ground and, you know, it doesn't matter. And ultimately what Benitez have been working at under these mad circumstances since 2005, the summer of 2005, was a title challenge. And he was only going to get one go. It transpired because of the circumstances at the club, and this was the one go, and it ebbs away, and this season's finished, out of the Champions League at the quarterfinal stage, unable to challenge for the title at this point. They go on, they get the 86 points. They're a really, really good side. They only lose two games all campaign, and they may well have had a better first 11 than Manchester United, but they didn't have the strength in depth, and this is what does for them, this game does for them, and it's a great way to be done for. Don't get me wrong, it really is a great way to be done for. I mean, we haven't talked about that fucking prick Arshavin yet, really.
His celebrations are so annoying.
Oh god, I know. And he was so apologetic afterwards, he just didn't understand. No, I think it is. It's desperately sad, the game, but it's also, as I say, you know, if you're not gonna do it, what a way not to do it, what a football match not to do it in. It was so fast. It was so fast this second half. It was one of the fastest games we've seen up to that point, and it was the direction football was going in, but Liverpool couldn't keep up the wider tempo, which is the point that you needed, and it was all gonna go badly wrong from here and not reemerge arguably properly until 13-14.
I remember feeling so hard done to after this match. I just thought two losses all season and we're not gonna win the league. I thought I remember saying after it, we're jinxed, I'm never gonna see us win the league. And then obviously I thought, you can't lose two games and not win the league. And obviously last season we only lose one game and still not win the league. But I just remember thinking, if only we'd have pushed on. I can't think of this season without thinking about that West Ham game earlier on, where we draw 1-1 and to go top of the league, but we're booed to the top of the league. And around that time, we couldn't. But some weeks we'd win 4-5-0, but other weeks we just couldn't get the goals we needed. And it's back to Neil's point there, as he said, by this stage of the season, we're running out of legs because basically we've got probably 12 or 13 players, and the rest of them are a real, real filler. Whereas United had a squad of probably 18 to 20 players who you could have all dropped in and dropped out as and when they needed to. And that's why they sort of churn this league title out, whereas Liverpool were trying to sort of blast it and it just didn't work.
Arshavin gets 6 goals all season, by the way. 4 of them are in this one night. He gets 6 goals all season. couple of weeks, as I say, a week later, United up against Tottenham, and after we go to Hull and win, and United are playing Tottenham, and we're in the car listening to it on the way back, and Tottenham go 2-0 up, and they've seen off United, and then Big Howard gives a ridiculous penalty to Manchester United, and it goes the other way, and genuinely the whole feeling cursed thing, I mean, abso-fucking-lutely, it's all in here. Some fella turns up, as I say, he's barely scored a goal for Arsenal by the time he trots up to Anfield, and he gets four in a night, and and even when we go 4-4, and I genuinely remember being in the ground thinking we're going to win this 5-4, genuinely thought we're going to go and win this 5-4. Benitez going berserk because of how many men they throw up at 3-3 and no one's on the cover, which, haven't watched 07-08 where Walcott runs the length of the pitch that season, you can completely see his fucking point. the whole enterprise is just, it does make you feel like, you know, coming off the ground, being absolutely broken, being upset, laughing my head off, but being upset at the same time. I can honestly remember it just being like, what a way to not do this. This is crazy. But what are you meant to do here? Because we can't do any more than we're doing.
Arshavin and Federico Makeda. Fucking hell. What a couple of absolute non-entities to take the league off you.
Okay. We'll move on from there. We'll go forward 4 years. It's 2013 now. It's Liverpool 2, Chelsea 2. There's a lot of Luis Suarez in this game. I'd forgotten just how much Luis Suarez there was in this game. There's obviously the bite. There's the famous bite on Ivanovic. But yeah, he's so much. He's in this game of football. You couldn't keep him out of it. It's Rodgers' first season. Things had turned around for him in January. He'd obviously managed to get some players in. But it's interesting that he leaves Sturridge out of this to go a little bit more solid. Torres also starts for Chelsea, which I've forgotten, and Rafa Benitez is the Chelsea manager on this day. The Sturridge shout doesn't work. He brings him on at half time and he scores almost straight away. It's a gorgeous assist from Suarez too, and I wonder in the madness of all this, Neil, of everything else going on, it does sort of make a bit of a decision for Brendan Rodgers in terms of the way forward for him and the way forward of his team, because, as I say, he leaves Sturridge out to try and be clever and sensible. Clever and sensible wasn't really what this football team was ever going to be about.
No, he does Coutinho for him, though, so yeah. I think there's still the remnants of him trying not to say we're going to throw absolutely everything at every minute of every game here. So I think there is an element of, he's still not entirely sure that he wants to be irresponsible. I mean, I think it is worth saying that a lot of what gets referred to as Brendan Rodgers' impetuosity is actually pragmatism, that he realises the best way to win football matches is to throw all the boss attacking lads at it. Because you can see that now, and you could see it at Swansea. I mean, the Wenger spoke of Swansea's sterile domination, the fact that they would just keep the ball forever but not try to create a great deal. And there's a little bit that Rodgers actually pragmatically chooses to be more attacking, and he does it in this game. And I think that you're right to say, John, that there's nothing wrong with, when in doubt, get all your best players on the pitch, and certainly get your best two lads you can attack playing with one another. And it's interesting that one sets up one, and then the final goal, Sturridge is credited with the assist. So as you say, it may well have pointed to Brendan Rodgers, and from his point of view and from Sturridge's point of view as well, you're able to come off the pitch feeling as though, well, you won the second half 2-1. Put everything else to one side, you won the second half 2-1 against the Chelsea side, who really, could have done with getting all 3 points. Chelsea weren't being soft here. They weren't playing at this. They were in a situation where, yes, the league's gone to United, but you look beneath there, and after this game's finished, Arsenal have played 34, won 63 points. Chelsea 33-62 and Tottenham 33-61, and there's only two Champions League places for those three teams up for grabs. So this was a game, yes, a point all right, but Chelsea could really have done with getting all three for their ambitions over the course of the season. So no, I think it does point something out to Rodgers that he can have the pair of them on the pitch at the same time in big games. They both deliver for him, and it may well be that it is a part of the blueprint going forward, because Liverpool don't have any more big games in the second half of this season after this point.
No. I mean, the game's famous for the Suarez bite, Kev, but 10 minutes before that, Suarez gives away a penalty. He thinks he's been shoved, clearly. He throws his hand in the air and sort of punches it away, and the referee hasn't really got any choice. And we don't know we can't be sure that one leads to the other, because I mean Suarez isn't a big communicator at the best of times, and you know, who knows what's going through his mind at any one time. But you'd imagine, knowing what we do know about Luis Suarez and how absolutely fuming he looked afterwards, that there is that frustration, the build up that eventually does lead to the bite.
Yeah, I think there might be a little bit more to the bite than that. I remember coming out thinking, what a fucking dickhead. I absolutely loved him. Excuse me. But I remember thinking, he was angling for a move away from Liverpool at this time. And he wasn't doing anything to sort of, to endear himself. And when he'd done it, I remember a bit of me thinking, do you know what? As good as he is, he's not worth the fucking hassle. Obviously, he goes on throughout the season, he has the following year, and thank God we didn't sell him. But you forget after this game, it's probably, what, 6 weeks, 2 months, and he's threatening to go on strike to move to Arsenal. It was such a mad time, and he was a fantastic player, but I remember just thinking at that time, do you know what, you're doing me head in here. And I could understand where he was coming from. We were behind Everton when we went into this game, and I think we finished behind them this season. We'd only won 13 games up to this point. We were basically crap, and he was obviously on a trajectory to be one of the best players in the world. But the frustration angle, I didn't buy it. It felt a little bit premeditated to me. Not necessarily premeditated that I'm going to bite Ivanovic, but that I'm going to do something absolutely fucking mental to make it easy for me to go in the summer.
Yeah, you look back on it now, Neil, there's a time where, you know, there was a lot of drama around him. It was sort of stressful, I would say. You know, when everyone, you know, we would go on to talk about the ban, and Liverpool always felt like they had to, I think, stick up for Suarez a little bit. Like, we always felt like we had to, you know, you support your man, and you know that. And I don't think that was just because he was our best player. I think there was elements of wanting to do that anyway. But I know what Kev's saying about feeling like, you know, oh, is this kind of a thing too far? Because it always felt like there was going to be something, and it was just taking a lot of energy out the football club.
I think there's definitely an element of that. I mean, the main thing I'd say about the bite is that Ivanovic isn't half sound about it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Both on the pitch and in the post match. I mean, he almost comes out post match and goes, "Ah, well, it happens." Like, it doesn't, to be honest with you. To be honest with you, Branislav, it doesn't happen all the time. You know, he really does come out and have a real sort of vibe of, "Well, I've seen worse." So you know, I think it possibly helps us that day that Benitez is also the Chelsea manager, in terms of the fact that Benitez, both his own personality, but also the fact that he's got obviously the fondness for Liverpool, doesn't want to stoke anything. He leaves the incident to be the incident that it is. And I think that helps. I think there may well be something in what Kev said, in that, you know, if that's the case, then there's an argument that that's part of the World Cup thing as well, that happens in the summer of 2014, and makes it, by that sort of stage, pretty close to untenable from Liverpool's point of view to keep hold of him. I don't know. I always feel with Suarez that I have such a quite a complicated relationship with him, to be honest with you, in that I think he'll never be as exciting as he was, and I don't think he ever was exciting as he was as when he played for Liverpool. But then I think that part of all of that is that so much of everything was on the edge all the time. So much of everything, all the football that he played, was just existed on this edge. And I think he's not been on that edge for most of the time he's been at Barcelona, because ultimately he's not needed to be. His job is to be the best possible person to provide things for Leo Messi, and he's just bought into that completely. Whereas I think at Liverpool, he just spent his life at this unbelievably high pitch. I mean, it's his 30th goal of the season, which I had no real sense of. It's his 30th goal all comps, and only when I was looking into this did I go, oh god, that's interesting. You know, we go on and we've got three more games until the end of the campaign. We score 10 and only concede one. We get 6 at Newcastle, and you're left wondering if he might have actually got 35, 36 goals if he hadn't have done the bite. And what a strange sentence that is. I think it's so hard, because I think there's obvious sort of issues, obviously, with his behaviour through his time at Liverpool, and I think you've got to contextualise all of that in there. But in the same, like, I think, you know what you said, John, that you felt exhausted. I think he felt exhausted.
Yeah.
And I think that's the really strange thing with him. I think he was like, I suspect he was probably doing his own head in a bit as well. If there is something in there about a move, I mean, what does it say of someone that they don't feel? You know, he's got a fucking release clause, Kev, or at least he thinks he has at this point. But it's not enough to have a release clause. I've got to start biting, lads. I mean, Jesus. You know, and I think that all of that, like, imagine being trapped in that head. That's no battle of laughs. And I don't know, I think it's so, it's all so out there that, I mean, it is crazy to think, I mean, it probably aged me, to be honest with you. It is crazy to think that all of that is still only 7 years gone, that it was only 7 years ago. It simultaneously feels like an age ago and yesterday that all this mad shit was happening, but basically Ivanovic's sound.
Yeah, and that's fair. He gets a 10-match ban, Kev. He gets a 10-match ban for this.
And the document was mad. Sorry to jump in. The document was bananas because one of the arguments around the ban was he'd done it on telly. As if the fact that he's bitten a lad wasn't enough, it was that he'd done it on telly and he was a high-profile player. And I think you and I, John, went on the radio with the day the document came out and said, so if Tony Hibbert stabs someone in a Stoke game that's not televised, it's nowhere near as bad. You know, there was loads of bit to create. Like, it wasn't enough just to sort of write a document that said, to be honest with you, we're going to have to ban him for 10 games because he bit someone, you know. It became this, like, it was this epic thing, wasn't it, John? It was like, it genuinely was like this unbelievably complex legal document that explained something that was perfectly rational, which is you can't go around biting people, and if you do, you're going to get long bans.
Yeah, I mean, they almost didn't know how much to do. They plucked the number out because it was sort of unprecedented. I remember someone, you know, as Liverpool fans do, finding a clip of it. I think it was Jermaine Defoe, like playfully biting someone on the floor and going, oh, he's, you know, he got a yellow card, I think. But it was like, well, this just did feel like a little bit different, the way he kind of sinks his teeth into him. And yeah, maybe 10 was a bit harsh, but then what are you arguing for, 7 or 8? Do you know what I mean?
to be honest with you, Your Honour, it is a bite. We accept that it's a bite, but...
But come on!
Ivanovic is sound about it, you know, and he's fucking sound. He's got on with his life. He's not bothered. He gets bit all the time.
Well, apparently so. Yeah, apparently so. Oh, I don't know. The paper's got some good puns out of it anyway. So I was. LFC history shows you the front and back pages of the next day's papers, and it was front and back. It was a big deal. Chewy Suarez, my personal favourite, but you know there is a few in there. I'll let you peruse them at your leisure. Okay, we'll move on. Done two games, now we're going to do a birthday. It's Adam Morgan. Happy birthday to Adam Morgan, if you are listening. 26 today he is. It's interesting, it's come up the day after. There's an article in The Athletic. I'll start with you, Neil, because you're in it. On being Liverpool, a retrospective look at the documentary, which featured, well, Brendan Rodgers' first very early time as Liverpool manager, the end of Kenny Dalglish and the start of Rodgers. And Adam Morgan is both in the documentary very heavily and also, you know, features it in the story about it. And he talks of pride almost, really, of seeing kind of his status there. And it's a reminder of a lot of things, you know, that piece, you know, that the being Liverpool madness. You know, one of the things is that Adam Morgan at the time was deemed, you know, rightly or wrongly, as one of the most, you know, the next kind of off the rank. Obviously, Raheem Sterling was the superstar, but of the small group of ones who were kind of, you know, just behind him, Adam Morgan was there.
Yeah, he was. It was. I mean, there's a really, really good book called The Next Big Thing by Ryan Baldy, and one of the chapters is about Adam Morgan, and the premise of the book is it's referring to football's, he uses the phrase, well, I don't think Ryan does, the publicist does, wonder kids and what does or doesn't happen to them, and the ones who don't make it, the ones who don't kick on, and that's who he speaks to. So there's a lot of, he does chapter by chapter looking at a number of different players and talks to them about their experiences, and it's very, very good indeed. And in there, I think Morgan's story is one of the sweetest, but simultaneously just a little bit sad, because he ultimately, what he struggles with is you know, when Rodgers uses the phrase weight of the shirt, I think that's one of the things that happens to Adam Morgan. I think he, and it isn't just the weight of the shirt, it's the weight of the dressing room. I think that we, there's a story about Gerrard and flattening Paul Ince and all of that sort of stuff that everyone loves, and everyone loves it because it tells you something about Stephen's commitments and the sort of personality that he had. But what that personality is sort of the personality that you need to make it. If you're going to walk into that sort of dressing room, you know, it's, I suspect one way or another, there's a moment that every player who's going to go on to be a genuinely excellent player has, whether it's by walloping someone or by doing some unbelievable piece of skill. There's the story of Guardiola saying to Xavi about Ian Iniesta, this fella's going to retire both of us. And I think that's the moment, I think, that, you know, every young player will have one. We like Gerrard because it involves him firstly being really physical and secondly nailing Paul Ince. And basically Adam Morgan's not capable, in a number of different ways it seems from this book, of having one. He's in awe of Gerrard and Carragher from the minute he gets into that dressing room, absolutely in awe of them, and he's very honest about it. He thinks these are phenomenal footballers. He's never quite a full sort of raw talent in the way that, for instance, Fowler was for quality, but he's got this mantle of the next Scouse thing, massive hype about the lads, all of this sort of stuff. He's got all of this because he's been sticking them in, but the all-round game was never quite there, and the people who at the time were tempering that were sort of seen as naysayers because that hadn't really been a new Liverpool superstar who was going to come through. You know, for instance, if you try to think about it prior to Morgan, I think the previous player we were excited about was Pacheco, and he wasn't even from Liverpool. So I think all of this put all this pressure on him. He had all that pressure on himself. He gets into a dressing room where he may not have been good enough. It comes with all this pressure, and then he's looking at these fellas and he's in awe of them because they're his heroes. And I think all of that just leads to him finding it so difficult, and I genuinely feel really sorry for him. And when you read the book, the chapter in Baldy's book, you feel even more sorry for him.
Yeah, I mean, no one backs a Scouser more than you, Kev, so I'm sort of, you know, glad you're on this. But, you know, it is worth pointing out, you know, he's a regular at England youth level, which not all of our players are. You know, it's tough to get into those teams, and there's plenty of, you know, been good Liverpool players who haven't really featured, you know, for England. I think even Gerrard, it takes him a while to sort of get in, but he's a regular for the under-17s and under-19s. He scores 22 in a season for the under-18s for Liverpool. There's compliments from Robbie Fowler about his finishing, which is enough to get anyone excited. And so, you know, there was a bit of hype there, wasn't there?
There was plenty of hype around him. And when he came into the team, he'd been scoring goals for fun at the under-18s and under-23s levels, or reserves as it was then. And he looked like the Fowler-type poacher. Not necessarily maybe what you'd expect in a modern-day striker, or maybe what you need in a modern-day striker with the all-around game. But when he was scoring, you just think, if you can do it, if you've got a natural finisher, you can sort of teach them the other bits. And obviously he comes in and he goes to America when that being Liverpool documentary is made, and he didn't even know he was going on that trip. I've listened to it since I knew we were doing this. I listened to a podcast with him, and he talks very candidly about it. He says, I was just a kid, like, I was loving being a footballer, but I wasn't really a footballer yet. He said, in the next minute I get told, oh yeah, get your stuff ready, you're going to America tomorrow. And he was like, what do you mean I'm going to America? And he's like, he was absolutely amazed. So he said, when he went there, he gets there and he's like, oh my God, this is amazing, I can't believe it. He said, and then he plays a game and he's boss and he scores a goal. And he's like, oh my God, what's going on here? And he just keeps saying all the time, my head just fell off. And then as he's coming through his Liverpool career, he comes on for his debut against Hearts in the UEFA Cup, last 5 minutes, whatever, but then he starts the home leg as well. And to hear him talking about that, I think people look at him and you think, oh, I feel a bit sorry for him, or what a sad way it is. But to hear him talk about it, he's like, no matter what else has happened in my football career, no one will ever be able to take away from me the fact that I started the game for Liverpool up front with Luis Suarez and Steven Gerrard in the team. It's amazing. And he's obviously had a bit of a bad time after Liverpool. He went to Yeovil, he could have gone. He's a bit of a cautionary tale to maybe take your time when you're making decisions, especially when it's in football, because he's left a club like Liverpool and he could have signed for Leicester, he says in this podcast I listened to. He said, but Leicester wanted to then send him out on loan somewhere. So he said, instead of signing for them, I went and signed for Yeovil instead. He said, well, what I should have done was gone to Leicester and then gone to Yeovil on loan. And that's a decision he can tell he looks back on with regret now, because you make them decisions at your peril, because I'll just go there and I'll prove this, and it doesn't work out for him. And then every subsequent move is just a level down. He's playing semi-professional now. He still plays for the love of the game, but he's very much he hasn't fulfilled his potential, or whether he was never really good enough in the first place, to be honest. But I really like Adam Morgan, and as you say, no one in the world's got more faith in Scousers than me. So when he broke through, I was praying for another Fowler.
I've read a few things he's done as well. I haven't listened to this podcast that Kev's talking about. I'll have to check it out. But I did read, I remembered the article that you talked about, the book you talked about, Neil, because you interviewed him for the Anfield Rap, didn't you? So that's kind of a bit, you know, knocking about somewhere. He also did something with Si Hughes about a year ago, when he talks about, you know, his career and what does or doesn't happen. And his career after Liverpool is mad. I counted up 14 of the clubs he's played for, and he's 26.
Yeah.
There's some clubs, well, I say plays for, there's some clubs where he goes and moves before he's even played. Yeah, you know, he joins one at the start of the summer and goes to another one in the end. I think that's happened this summer when one minute he was going to Widnes because he wants to be near home, and then now I believe he's playing for Romford, which is in Essex, isn't it? Romford, certainly London way. And so that suggests a bit of an about turn. And what comes through for me, and I don't know if you agree, is that, you know, while some kids dream of playing for being a footballer, some kids are, I just want to be a footballer. For Morgan, it just seemed to me like he wants to play for Liverpool. And when that didn't happen, he's just never quite recovered.
I think that's a really good point, John. I think it's one which I think, for instance, we talk a lot about Stephen when he first comes through, and about sort of like the advice that he gets, and that he's sort of a bit media trained and he's a bit taciturn. But the one thing you can say, he's absolutely focused on one thing, and that's being the best player he can be. And that's part of what leads to the idea that he might move away, which, you know, we all despise. But one of the things about that is that Gerrard is determined to be a brilliant footballer. Wayne Rooney is determined to be a brilliant footballer. Gerrard, I think, becomes and accepts and blossoms in the context of being a Liverpool legend. But, you know, if we don't win in Istanbul, or if we don't qualify for the Champions League the season before, Gerrard would have gone. You know, there's no, and I'm fine with that. You know, the point about this is that if you're going to have brilliant football, you know, if something terrible happens to Liverpool now when we're languishing in ninth, then in four seasons' time, five seasons' time, you know, we're languishing ninth with a crap manager, Trent Alexander-Arnold should go. Because the purpose of Trent Alexander-Arnold is to be the best version of himself. And I think that Trent Alexander-Arnold would go. I think with Adam Morgan, as you say, it's very much, this is all about Liverpool. And that's one of the reasons why he can't get over sharing the dressing room with Carragher and Gerrard. He can't break away from this idea that these are not just the best footballers, but the best men. I think is part of it as well, and it isn't just learning from them, it's being in awe of them, and they're two quite different things. And I think that, you know, I think it you need different players around you at different times to give you the right sort of advice. And another thing that we maybe don't talk about enough, not least because everybody involved is very modest, but is how important, for instance, someone like McAllister was on Gerrard, where he wasn't absolutely iconic in the way in which Gerrard might have found someone like, you know, again, we can not like this, but Brian Robson or Roy Keane. But he was a certain age, and he was able to sort of to really be respected by Gerrard, but help him through. I think that in this instance, Morgan, it isn't just that he respects them, it's that he's in absolute awe of him, absolute awe of his surroundings. This is the dream. He is living the dream right now. Whereas for Stephen, the dream was all the trophies and was being seen as the best player of your generation. For Adam Morgan, he probably knows he's not the best player of his generation. He probably plays with 10 lads who are all better than him on England duty. So the dream's happening now, and then it never really properly happens, and it is sad.
Yeah, snatched away. Well, happy birthday to him anyway. I hope he's having a good time wherever he is. I wonder where he is. Do try and read up on the stuff. As I say, the Si Hughes article is really good. I'm going to check out the podcast that Kev's talking about. And yeah, if we can dig out what Neil did with Ryan Baldy, it was a really good show.
Back when you could go to pubs.
You did it in a pub. Imagine, I'm going to do all my shows in a pub when I can. I'm going to do a month to them. That's where I'll be. You want me? I'm in the line. Thanks a lot to everyone for joining me. And if you for listening, that's been On This Day for Another Day. We've got a bit of a surprise tomorrow. Looking forward to it. But nice one. Have a good day. See you later.
What's the surprise?
Carragher's doing it. Yeah.